KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling a documentary airing tonight on the public television station KUED. It's about the battle over the Bears Ears National Monument. Producer Nancy Green will join us to explain how the story has played out in the years since the monument was created and then rescinded. She explores the role of Native Americans in the story and how racism has been an undercurrent. But she also shows how all of the sides in this dispute feel like no one is listening. We'll be right back.
They say all politics is local, and KUER reporters are here to bring you Utah stories, news that affects you here at home, like public lands and water issues, religion, and the tech boom. You can trust KUER to bring you the facts and thoughtful analysis of why the story matters. Listen to KUER on air at 90.1, stream us at KUER.org, and here's a pro tip. If you've got a smart speaker, tell it you want to listen to NPR, and Alexa or Google will take you right there.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When President Trump significantly reduced the size of the Bears Ears National Monument last year, it stirred up the same kinds of arguments that came up when President Obama first created it. And those were the same kinds of arguments that came up when President Roosevelt was considering federal protections for that land back in the 1930s. In a new documentary produced by the public television station KUED, Bears Ears is described as just the latest flashpoint for issues that have been fought over for decades. But these aren't just disputes about land policy or the role of the federal government. The film shows how Bears Ears also reveals racial tensions between the white communities and the Native Americans that are just beneath the surface. Today in the program, KUED producer Nancy Green is joining us to talk about her film. It's called The Battle Over Bears Ears. It's airing on KUED this evening. Green says what's new about this very old dispute over land is that Native Americans now are getting involved in a way they haven't been before. And that's what got her interested in the story.
Years ago, I had read an article about the fact that there was this monument being proposed, and they talked about land use issues and the typical conflicts that we often have in Utah. And but the thing that really made this story different was the fact that Native Americans were basically involved in this in a way that they hadn't really been before. So I thought that was really intriguing. And, I just thought it was an interesting story about how do we decide whose voices get heard? How do we decide on land policy in the state? It's been a contentious issue for as long as we've been a state, and even before. And so it really intrigued me. And I had no idea what twists and turns would then follow.
Yeah. Did this come before the idea and the way you were conceiving of it? Did it come before Donald Trump became president?
Yeah, it was way before Donald Trump became president, and I, like many people, didn't see that coming. And so originally we were, thinking, well, if it does become a monument, what's our story? If it doesn't become a monument, what's our story? And that really was the tension we were looking at. And then all of a sudden, Donald Trump got elected, and the monument had already been declared, but then the whole fate of the monument then became in question. And so really, it became more about following that process, too.
Did it surprise you how deeply personal this is and how everyone has their own perspective that's based on their personal view, but that is entirely different from another personal view? I mean, the perspectives are so different.
They really are. It was surprising to me. I mean, I knew people felt passionately about the land, but I didn't realize how much history came into play, personal history and personal connection. And and it's funny because I'm, I'm mostly an urban dweller. I love the desert Southwest and I love the landscape, but I just didn't understand how deep those ties run. What it's like to live in an area for generation after generation.
It's like, and it's more complicated than this, but in some ways there are these two cultures going on. One has been on the land a little bit longer, but both are deeply connected to it. You've got the white sort of Anglo culture, of course, there, and then deeply embedded are the First Peoples, the indigenous peoples, and both of them talk about the land in similar ways, like that it's sacred keeps coming up. That's a word that keeps coming up. And their connection is really kind of profound, both of them.
Mm-hmm. And it is. And that's something that I found, that there was a lot of common language. People would talk about an area being special or sacred. But I think how they define that notion of sacredness, what that actual connection was slightly different for different people. And it was interesting because you couldn't necessarily say, you know, this is an Anglo versus Native American, anti versus pro. I mean, people were on different sides of the issue.
Yeah.
So it wasn't such a black and white thing to discern.
No. And we'll talk about that, by the way, because I think it's particularly interesting, I have to say, I think people think about or have thought about Native Americans as having one monolithic concept of it. But one of the things you reveal in the film is, in fact, and I guess we know this, that there's not complete agreement about that monument within the Native American community.
Yeah, and there isn't. I mean, there's you know, a large majority that are pushing for the monument, but there was a vocal minority inside of San Juan County who were speaking up against it.
Tell me about Angelo Baca.
Angelo, he's amazing. He's a filmmaker. He's a sociocultural anthropologist. He's getting his PhD. He's also an activist, and he is part of Utah Dene Bikea, a group that's been pushing for the monument. And he really opened up my eyes to a lot of, I think, cultural attitudes. He told me many different things. You know, he taught me about history. He said, for a lot of Native American elders, he said, history is... it's different than maybe Anglos think about it, that it's, or I think about it. He said that it's really this notion of history is really near, that things like the Long Walk, or even, you know, Brigham Young coming into the valley, things like the Mountain Meadows Massacre, all those incidents that those conflicts feel like much more recent history. And so he really talks a lot about this notion of worldviews and trying to understand different ways of viewing the world and how they, I think, how it makes sometimes difficult, you know, how it makes conversation sometimes difficult.
Yeah. I want to play a moment from the film. This is Angelo Baca talking about his grandmother and how she was supportive of this idea of preserving this land, and how he saw, how his grandmother saw the land as this place of healing and prayer.
Up to the very last year, my grandmother was picking the medicines, you know, up to the very last. We were going up there, and she was telling me the history. She was telling me the place. That place is a sacred place for lots of reasons. It's a place of civility, of discourse, of peacemaking, of harmony. It actually is the spirit of the bear, and that's respected in all the cultures.
What is that, the spirit of the bear?
I think that a lot of it's interesting about bear's ears is that it's actually in different native languages, they all refer to it as the bear's ears.
Yeah.
And it's viewed as this place of healing. It's this place of where they gather herbs, where they can gather particular elements for ceremony. And I had the spiritual advisor for Utah Dene Bikea tell me that region, that those ears were actually integral to the health and healing of the world, that it held particular significance for him and for his tribe. And so I think it's rather ironic in a way that this place of healing, this place of coming together, this place of, you know, finding herbs is also at the center of so much contention. And when I asked Angelo about that, he said that that's part of the healing process, that it's not, you know, maybe it's good we're getting out all of this animosity, we're airing different views. Maybe that's just part of the process of healing.
Jamie Bayless is another, she sort of represents now another kind of cultural perspective, another connection to the land. Tell us about her.
So Jamie is an activist. She's local to Blanding. she just felt like this process wasn't done correctly, you know, deep in her bones. This land is really, you know, to her, this land is sacred too. She talks about growing up and having all these experiences on the land, about, you know, learning to hunt on there, learning to drive. And she also has a very profound moment on the land where she talks about it was a place where her boyfriend actually ended up dying in the spot on the land. And so it's very deep and very important to her what happens in that region. And she just felt like this process wasn't done correctly. And I think she really just wanted a restart. She wanted a do-over. But again, she's really just one of those very passionate people who really has devoted a lot of time to fighting the monument because she felt like it just wasn't the right thing.
Let me play another moment here. We hear from Jamie. We also hear from Phil Lyman. He's a former San Juan County Commissioner, just elected, by the way, to the legislature last Tuesday, giving this sense that this particular group of people, these locals, when this monument was created, weren't taken into account. Here's another moment from the film.
We're not anti-monument, and we're not pro-drill. You know, it's just we were so against the process and how, you know, how can we have all of our elected officials in the state of Utah, in all of San Juan County, agree on one thing? But no, a monument is not the right thing for this area. It feels like we were purposely left out of even having a say. Like everybody else around us has a say, but San Juan County doesn't.
A national monument should be an honor to any county. Well, that's not what Bears Ears is at all. You know, 1.35 million acres, it covers anything and everything, and it's totally politically motivated.
It's not about protection. It's about these other organizations who want to profit off of it. They want to make it their playground. They don't give a shit about the locals, the ones that have been taking care of the area for generations. That's the frustrating thing, is it's going to be a circus.
Here's where there's an irony that I think some people will detect, that you have people like Jamie Bayless and Phil Lyman saying, hey, we've been left out of the process. And you have Native Americans who are saying, yeah, we've been left out of the process too. Historically, we've completely been left out of the process. And that's an interesting irony, I think, in the film.
Yeah, I mean, it did strike me that everyone felt marginalized.
Yeah.
Everyone felt marginalized. And obviously you have Native Americans who have traditionally, I mean, been an incredibly marginalized group in terms of power structure and, you know, American society. And then you have, you know, the ranchers. They feel like no one's listening to them, that they're kind of, you know, being besieged. You have, you know, people like Jamie and Phil feeling like San Juan County is, you know, is being marginalized in this discussion. And so that was one of the things that struck me, was this fact that no one feels heard.
Yeah. What is it like down there? I think a lot of people listening have been to San Juan County, maybe visited, but give us a sense what it's like to live there. You talked to Bill Boyle, who is publisher, editor of the San Juan Record. So he has a good position to be able to say what this place is like. And the one thing that I hadn't realized is he talks about how it's basically half Native American and half white. Small in population, but really diverse. What's it like? Did you get a sense of what it's like to live there?
I don't know if I can speak about what it's like to live there, but I, you know, it is a
what the locals say it's like to live there.
You know, they say it's small town. Yeah. It's, you know, your neighbor. You know, it's a bit of a frontier in a way. I mean, you certainly have, you know, some stores and things like that, but, you know, they don't have a lot of the amenities that people in larger cities do. It's a really, you know, you have people certainly in the major small towns, but it's a very large area with a very small population. And then you do have this incredible mix. You have, you know, you have a Ute reservation, you have a Navajo, you know, Diné reservation. You know, you have obviously a fairly large Anglo population, but it is split. You do go down and you do see a fair amount of diversity.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about how this particular issue brought these groups of Native peoples together, really for the first time. And I don't know how long. It's pretty extraordinary. I mean, one of the things that that you talk about in the film is how there were these groups. The Navajos didn't get along very well with the Hopi, and the Navajo didn't get along with the Utes, and the Utes didn't get along with the Hopi. But this is one of those things that's sort of drawn all of these different groups together.
Yeah, I mean, there's this real historical tradition of different groups fighting with each other and raiding and then you go into modern times and certainly there's been some different, you know, tensions between the groups over the years. But there is sort of this historical separation between them. And then all of a sudden they have this common goal and they manage to work out their differences. And they had to figure out, you know, what does sacred mean to the Hopi? What does it mean to the Navajo? What does it mean to the Ute? I mean, they had to work with each other. They had to decide what does protection mean? You know, what's the best way to go about doing this? And so they really did have to set aside differences and come together.
It's expressed pretty well by Regina Lopez White Skunk in the film. Tell us about her. I want to play this moment, but tell us about her.
Regina, she was on the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition, and she's a Ute, and she, really talks a lot about her connection to that region. She has a personal connection to Bears Ears, and she fought really hard to find common language, to bring people together, to work with different groups. And she also talks about, not so much in the film, but she talked to me a lot about the process leading up to Bears Ears. Mm. And she felt that there was a lot of disrespect, afforded to her and also to a lot of the Native Americans in the deliberation project process.
So. Let's play that moment.
The Navajo and the Hopi were not always on good terms. Neither were the Navajo and the Ute. And to be able to find that common ground and goal was absolutely imperative that we needed to heal from within.
What does she mean, heal from within?
I think there was those historic divisions.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think really, you can hang on to that animosity. Or you can find a way to move past it. And I think from what she told me, all of the various tribes had to find a way to move past those sort of ancient wounds and find a way to work together and come together and find that common language.
I think the thing that's interesting about this part, too, is they do come together. They're able to craft an agreement in some ways. And the thing that's interesting about it is this new twist is that Native Americans, at least that's the idea, are going to manage the land along with the federal government. That seems like a new twist, like kind of something unprecedented.
Yeah, and it was. And it was really, it was something that drove them. It felt like, here's this sense of equality. We finally have a seat at the table. But then I think the problem was this notion of what is co-management? What does it look like? They hammered out a lot of that. But what was interesting is when Obama declared the proclamation, when he declared the monument, presidents actually can't grant co-management rights that they were looking for. Yeah. It actually has to be granted by Congress. So then that became a point of contention, too, of, what does co-management look like? Can we really get co-management? And that became almost a talking point on both sides.
That's Nancy Green. Her new documentary is called The Battle Over Bears Ears. You can see it tonight at 8 on KUED Channel 7. For details and showtimes, just go to our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER teams up with local and national businesses around the state to support the station and bring you Utah stories and national news from NPR. If you've got a business, like a restaurant or a car repair shop, or maybe you take wedding photos or offer legal services, whatever it is, when you join KUER as a business sponsor, you're helping people who care deeply about facts and storytelling stay connected to their community, all while building your company's brand. Learn more about becoming a sponsor at KUER.org.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling a documentary airing tonight on the public television station KUED. It's about the battle over the Bears Ears National Monument. Nancy Green is joining us. She produced the film. It's called Battle Over Bears Ears. The contention made in the film by people like Republican Congressman Rob Bishop and Phil Lyman, we heard of before, is that these Native groups are just kind of being manipulated by these environmental front groups, as they put it, radical environmental groups. And Lyman mentions in the minutes of the environmental groups, there's this idea that, in fact, they explicitly are saying, let's hitch our success to the Navajos. Talk a little bit about that contention, this idea that these Native groups aren't really that invested. They're just being kind of manipulated by these white outside groups.
Yeah, I think for Representative Bishop and Phil Lyman, they saw, and especially Phil Lyman, I think he saw that there was this process that was going on and there were discussions that were happening. And then in his mind, all of a sudden, these outside environmental groups started giving money and backing Native American groups, and it changed the discussion for him. And so, you know, he sees that as this co-opting. He sees it as these environmental groups had this agenda. They had wanted to preserve that region for a long time. They couldn't get anything through. And now here they can by, you know, and it says in these minutes, hitching, you know, our success. And so, you know, he did. He really genuinely believes that, that it's this, you know, front. And then you turn around and, you know, conversely, you can be like, well, you know, it's not unusual to have allies working in collaboration together. So you have these different viewpoints.
Yeah, one person's ally is another person's front group.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah, but it is, you know, I mean, you have to look at the attitude and the reaction from, you know, a lot of Native Americans is that's awfully condescending to say that we aren't leading this.
Precisely. And it's a point made by Regina Lopez Whiteskunk in this particular moment from the film and also Peter Metcalf, who is, of course, with the Black Diamond, former CEO of Black Diamond. He's featured in the film as well. We'll hear from him first in this particular moment, but this is their response to that idea.
To say that Native Americans are a proxy group for conservationists is absurd. To see the Hopis, the Navajos, the Utes, and the other tribes come together for the first time in their history to champion this, they're doing that on their own. They're not proxies of any white people.
Public lands belong to every citizen of the U.S.
The tribal leaders requested of these groups that they would support us, and if there's anything that the tribes would need, that they then could help. They were not to speak in behalf of the tribes. They were not to make any decisions.
It was the most diverse, eclectic group of advocates that had ever come together to fight for and champion the creation of a monument in the history of this country.
Yeah, that seems to be the response, is that, look, no, we've hammered this out ourselves. We've imposed these directives on these outside groups. We're driving it. I mean, that's something that it seems like these Native groups want it to be clear, that they're the ones, in fact, driving this. They're not being manipulated by white environmentalists.
Yeah, and to them, I mean, this is, you know, this is a huge accomplishment. To them, it's about, you know, coming together, fighting for something, and finally having, you know, they use this term, finally having a seat at the table, finally having a voice, finally not having...
We're inviting ourselves to the table, I think, as someone,
you know,
says.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We're inviting ourselves here and not having something just prescribed to them. I mean, they want to be the drivers of it. And so it is interesting to look at that power structure and the language around that.
Yeah. In the film, Phil Lyman, and I think it's that this is a contention from some people, is that, look, as President Obama did, he set aside that land, created the Bears Ears National Monument. He said that's not, in fact, the way, the best way anyway, to protect those ancient artifacts. In fact, he says in the film, that's the worst thing you can do. Talk a little bit about that and this part of the film, and whether, in fact, a monument does protect these artifacts. Because one of the archaeologists in the film concedes that initially the monument may cause more damage at first.
Yeah, I mean, the film brings up a good point. If you want to protect something, you know, is inviting people in, the best way to protect it, because you are going to have, you know, damage being done, and it's a valid point. And originally, people really were fighting for this to be more of a national conservation area, because people don't look on their, you know, holiday map and go, I'm going to go visit this national conservation area. You know, but monuments are different; they do draw people. But archaeologists, some of them argue that people are coming anyway. Visitation has been up. The area is needs protection, and the only way to really protect it is to have a management plan, to have, you know, bring additional funds, bring additional boots on the ground, and have an actual plan on how to deal and manage with this region. So, yeah, in the short term, you might have some more damage, but in the long term, they feel like it actually is the best way to protect it.
But it's one of the things that it seems like a lot of the locals really worry about. It's one thing that Jim Stiles worries a lot about. Tell us a little bit. Those who don't know, Jim has been an activist and engaged down in that part of the country for a good long time, and you were able to talk to him. He doesn't talk to everyone, by the way. I think it's interesting that you were able to get him. But that's one of his biggest worries. He's worried that environmental groups and others haven't taken into account the fact that tourists could come flooding into this place and dramatically change it.
Yeah, I mean, Jim's experience is Moab.
Yeah.
Moab, Utah. And that is, you know, that's been inundated with tourists and, you know, positive and negative impacts there. So he's seen that firsthand and reacted to it. And, and his notion is tourists, you know, yeah, they do bring some dollars, they do bring some industry, but there's a price to that. And that's what he's worried about. He's worried about the fact that, protecting landscapes, the impact on local communities, how it changes the flavor and the culture in a local community, how people come in who maybe don't value the same things that people who've been there for years do. So there's this real fear of these outsiders coming in and of change, and change maybe not in the way you want it to happen.
Here's Jim Stiles from the documentary.
When I first came out here in the 70s and 80s, there wasn't the recreational industry that there is now to begin with. And I don't think a lot of environmentalists ever really get the connection between consumption and production. It's easy for everyone to oppose every oil well that they ever see because it's going to damage the land, but then to have no problem with the tourist industry exploding, which depends by definition on the consumption of natural resources for them to get here, is a contradiction that I don't think a lot of people consider. I mean, we all know that industrial tourism and recreation has impacts. We know that's a fact. I mean, we can see it. You can see it at the Grand Canyon. You can see it in Moab and at Arches. And it's prevalent around the West. It's almost as if one side has said, well, we're going to ruin this place, but we think the way we're going to ruin it is better than the way the other guys are going to ruin it. And that's if you want to talk about irony, to me, that's the biggest one of all.
He used that word industrial tourism, which Peter Metcalf pushes back on. How are you getting, what kind of response are you getting from people like, well, Peter Metcalf in particular responds in the film to this idea? What's the response, I guess?
of industrial tourism.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
and,
people.
And to the term.
The term. Yeah. People, you know, sit there and go, well, this is ridiculous. I mean, it's, you know, it's tourism and it's an industry. But, you know, but what is industrial tourism? And I love it. Peter Metcalf actually says, like, what does that even mean? Is that like Disneyland, you know? And a lot of, you know, other groups have pushed back against, you know, Jim's, you know, the way he paints the picture of the impacts of tourism. And Andy brings out a great point that, you know, there is this irony that we're willing to, you know, flock to regions and yet not really look at the consequences or the impacts we have, you know, in those areas. So yeah, people definitely push back against this notion of, you know, what is industrial tourism?
It seems like this is the real challenge. Metcalf and others have talked about this, that when you have so-called legacy industries that are diminishing, ranching and farming, those kinds of things, that people in these rural communities, according to Metcalf anyway, are going to have to start embracing the potential and the possibilities of tourism, be more welcoming. And this seems like a real challenge for that region.
I think it is. And I think it's, you know, how do you maintain this core of your identity as a community and yet grow and bring people in? And I think, you know, if you can get people planning early on, you know, maybe you can allay, you know, just address some of those fears. Mm-hmm. But again, it is that notion of, you know, we fear change. But the reality is that, you know, a lot of these industries aren't sustainable. In a lot of these small communities, people are moving away and they do need to find ways to do something that's sustainable. But the problem is a lot of the, you know, the tourism jobs often don't pay the way maybe an oil and gas job, you know, could. So I think that's another issue for them is, you know, they don't always see that as a viable way forward. So it's a real issue. It's a real, you know, it's a real problem. I certainly don't have an answer to it.
Yeah. But you address it in the film. I mean, I don't think there are any answers, right? I mean, it's just raising these big questions, and these are the things they're going to have to work out.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just, you know, and I think that's the reality is there's validity to concerns on different sides.
Yeah.
And I think just having that empathy and understanding that, you know, like, I get where people are coming from.
Isn't that the point of the film in some ways?
Yeah. You know, we're so divided. You know, we're so polarized as a nation. And this fight, this discussion over bears ears has been incredibly polarized. And it is a reflection, you know, it's the microcosm of what's going on nationally in terms of just, you know, we need to listen to each other and maybe have some more empathy and understand where we're coming from in order to exact change that's actually meaningful instead of just yelling at each other. People weren't even yelling at each other. They were talking past each other. There were different conversations happening at different levels. It wasn't even, I'm just arguing with you. It was literally like different worldviews moving past.
Yeah. I think the worldviews question is absolutely fascinating. And it's something that I wanted to talk about because there are two dynamics here that I thought are particularly interesting. Let's talk about the Johnsons first, because this is a family, again, a ranching family, deeply embedded in that place. And they have a point of view which I want to talk about. Because one of the things that Jim Stiles and some other locals say is there's a lack of respect among, you know, progressives in urban environments who are talking about public land, environmental groups who don't really take into account and maybe even are demeaning or patronizing of the locals, you know, the ranching community. And this comes up in the film, this idea. To talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, they're you know, again, it's, you know, it's hard for me. I mean, I grew up in urban areas. It's hard for me to understand what it takes to be a rancher, to live off the land, to you know, survive on rainfall and be that connected to it. And it's also people who have, you know, maybe a different viewpoint about how land should be used. You know, they have a different connection to it. And unless you really start to understand those values, it's easy to say, well, look, it's, you know, you're being ridiculous. This isn't a viable way to live. You know, it's time to move on. Let's go move into the future. But it's this, you know, amazing tradition. It's a, it's a way of raising your children. Yeah. It's a way of, you know, going back generations. It's a way of being connected to a place that's unlike anything I've experienced. So I do. I think it's easy to dismiss somebody. You know, it's difficult to really try and sit and understand where they're coming from.
Let's play a moment. We'll hear from three of the Johnsons, Preston Johnson, Gail Johnson, who is Preston's mom, and Sandy is Preston's dad. Sandy seems great, by the way.
Sandy is great. They're all great, but Sandy is a character.
Yeah, yeah. You'll hear him. And Gail's terrific here, too. She's most prominently featured in this particular moment from the film.
Being out and doing what I've done all my life, it gives you a greater respect for what things are and where they come from. When the land gets dry and it's not greening up, and the brush and the grass isn't looking good, I'm feeling that too, because it's how I live, off the rain and the moisture we get and the cows, and I guess you could say it's sacred.
I believe this world is created by our Heavenly Father for man to live on, and man is to be the steward of that land, and he's to use it but not abuse it. You know, not just let it sit out there and look at it and go to waste or become somebody's playground from Wasatch Front or Washington D.C. or what else. He expects us to, you know, actually do something useful.
That's why I don't want this monument. I want it left here where we can ranch, where you can't trust the government. They say one thing and do something else. Well, they want it locked up just where nobody can use it is what they wanted to do it.
And it's a much bigger movement than let's protect the bears' ears. It's about protecting their jobs.
You're going to have to go find somewhere else to live, and you're going to have to go find something else to do to provide for your family. So, yeah, I feel like I'm under attack.
This land is sacred to me, and this land is my home. I choose to live here and raise my family because it's a good life. This is my American dream that I want and I've worked for. And they don't feel that way, and I know they don't. They just use the land as their ploy to, you know, to further their agendas of control and power and money.
Pretty strong words from Gail. And again, not taking into account the sort of well-meaning nature of environmentalists who might be down there. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, environmentalism down there has become a dirty word.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, I had somebody tell me that. And, you know, it's and Jamie actually talked about that with me. She said, you know, it shouldn't be. You know, environmentalism shouldn't be a dirty word. Environmentalist shouldn't be a dirty word. But but that's what it's become. And I think it's because people feel under siege. You know, they feel regulated to death and they feel like there is no end. And it was interesting. Gail said something to me. She said, you know, when you finish your documentary, what are you going to do? I was like, make another documentary. And she said, that's exactly what environmentalists are like. They never stop. It's like this area and then more and more and more. Mm. So she feels like it's never enough. And so I thought that was an interesting take. I hadn't thought of it that way.
Let's play Peter Metcalf's take because he responds to that idea in the film.
The overwhelming majority of people who have been advocates to champion this, they're not in it for the money. Patagonia wouldn't lose probably a dollar of sales, or Black Diamond wouldn't lose a dollar of sales if the area wasn't protected. But we're there championing it because we love the area. Our customers love this area. And many companies in the outdoor space feel like they represent the interests of their customers who want to see areas like this protected so that, yes, they can go recreate. So is there some self-interest to see beautiful, pristine, iconic, wild landscapes protected for recreational, hunting, sportsman uses? Absolutely, because we care, because we want our children to see, witness, and experience what we have the opportunity to witness. We're championing it because we believe in it. It's part of our humanity.
What I think is interesting about those two contrasting clips is that it really reveals the impasse there. One group believes it's part of their humanity, and the other group believes the same thing. And they can't seem to work those things out because they seem completely different in some ways.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the impasse in all of this is, you know, how do you get, you know, different views? I mean, I mean, Gail, you know, believes that land should be used, right? It's religious to her, right? It's spiritual.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then you have other people saying, you know, this is our temple. And then you come in on a totally different view. You know, obviously Native Americans have an intense spiritual connection to place.
Yeah.
And so you do. You have all these people with slightly, you know, which is these different definitions of what these things mean. And how do we find that common ground? I mean, I think that's the hard question.
I want to play something that Angela Baca says in the film, because I think to me it was such an important concept. He talks about how Native people see this differently from Western people, and it reveals just how complicated this is going to be because the perspectives are so different, as he'll outline here in this clip. It makes you realize I don't know how they're going to come to any kind of agreement if they have such different perspectives. Let's play this moment.
I think Indigenous people have a very long timeline, a long frame of how long they've been there. Anglo communities, I think they feel like they've arrived on the scene and it's... a claim has been staked and a place has to be defended, and walls are put up, fences are up, and defenses are up. I think Indigenous peoples do think in cycles, they think in circles, they think in completion, that everything's connected. And I think that a lot of Western Euro-American systemic thought is very linear. One group is thinking in squares and lines, and the other group is thinking in circles and cycles. So it's very, very different, even from the very beginning of conversations.
You have cycles and then you have squares.
Yeah.
So and how do you make those work? Because they're both different perspectives.
They are. And I think to Angelo, the whole concept is to come together and start acknowledging each other's views and go through a process, you know, really come together and have meaningful dialogue. And that's something a lot of people have said, that there hasn't been a lot of meaningful dialogue between groups. There have been attempts to bring people together, to negotiate, but it always feels like we're negotiating where we listen to everyone, but then we're going to tell you what's going to happen to this land. Mm-hmm. And so from all different sides, people are saying there's not this sense of being heard. There's not this sense of real, you know, sitting across the table negotiating back and forth. There was a process that started in San Juan County, and it had years ago, and it had some success, but that was preempted by other political processes, and well, we see where we are now.
I want to talk to you about Danielle Shirley, because this is another angle to this story, another element, which again shows how complicated the broad story is. Tell us a little bit about her, because this is another really profoundly personal part of the story.
Yeah, Danielle's her grandmother actually has been one of the people at the fore in the fight against the monument. She's been very vocal. And Danielle also is an activist against it. But for her, she's a student advocate at a school in Monument Valley. And so she's fighting, you know, and working with a lot of Navajo kids, and sees their everyday reality. And for her, there were reasons to be against the monument. She was concerned about, you know, can we gather firewood? Can we have access to our land? You know, this is spiritual. This is sacred to us. She didn't want people walking all over it. Mm-hmm. But there was another component, and it had to do with those children that she, you know, teaches and is an advocate for every day. And it really is this notion of those kids don't have food. Those kids, a lot of them, they don't have electricity. They don't have running water. There are a lot of deep needs, you know, on the Navajo reservation. And she feels like, why are people spending money on this sort of esoteric, you know, conversation when there are just such critical daily needs that aren't being addressed?
It's my life, it's my people, it's my home, my family. That is our temple. That's our source of life right there. And you're just allowing it for everyone up to utilize and to walk over, to trash, to pollute it, to not understand how sacred it is to us. That's where it hurts.
You said this was one story that almost broke you?
So, I think the story in general almost broke me.
Is that right?
Yeah, just the whole process of this. I mean, there were so many voices, But Danielle, I think Danielle surprised me because, you know, that was an aspect I hadn't really thought about.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's obviously a very personal story for a lot of people. But to see that suffering firsthand and to deal with it every day, you know, I could really see how she felt forgotten by, you know, a lot of the people inside of this process, whether it was the national government or whether it was, you know, her tribal government. She really did feel like, you know, these are the forgotten people.
Yeah. One of the things we didn't talk about yet, but it's another complicating factor, yet another one, that is the idea of how you treat these artifacts. Because there's the sense, of course, that and it's true that, you know, people have been looting artifacts in that region for a very long time. The federal government, this is in 2009, July of 2009, which you mentioned, a large number of federal agents roar in, storm in, however the perspective is, because everyone has a different view of what exactly happened. And then they arrested, you know, 17 people. It was a sting operation that had been in the works for years, trying to end the black market for these antiquities. And this is another really complicating factor here, because everyone... I mean, the locals were absolutely outraged about the way that was conducted.
Yeah, I mean, it really was this crucible moment. There had been raids before in the 80s, but this one, you know, the way it went down and what happened and the personal toll. There was a beloved doctor, yeah. Dr. Red, who committed suicide during this time, and there were other factors, but I mean, that was a big shock to the community. And Bill Boyle talks about it, and he basically says that instead of people this being a wake-up call and going, okay, we have to treat antiquities in a different way, it really became just another reason to resent and mistrust the federal government. They saw it as this incredible, ridiculous overreach, a ridiculous response. And it was just one more thing that now, why should we trust the government?
Yeah. I want to come back to the Native American perspective. Sean Chaput, you feature him in the film toward the end, and he's talking. He's chair, by the way, of the Ute Indian Tribal Business Committee. And he says something that I think is really interesting. We had him on our program as well, and he said something very similar, that we're here now. We may have been in the background in the past, but we're not going away. Let me play this moment because I want to get you to talk a little bit about this particular part. Here's Sean Chaput.
We've awoken as Indian people. The Ute tribe, the Navajo Nation, the Zuni tribes, the Pueblos, and all the other tribes in North America have finally decided enough's enough. All it took was for them to honor their responsibility to Native American tribes and actually put aside our differences and talk about common interests which could benefit us all. But they chose not to. I'm sorry that we had to witness this, but we're ready for the fight that's ahead of us. So thank you.
He, of course, is talking about the fact that Donald Trump rescinds the monument in the process, where, as you say, where we are now. But I guess that's one of the things you learned. Native American groups are pretty insistent they're not going away and they're going to stay involved in this.
Yeah, I mean, they're staying in the fight. I mean, Trump shrank the monument by 85% and created two new monuments. And it's interesting as he named one, Shasja, which is the Diné, or Navajo word for bear's ears,
yeah.
But that discounts all the other tribes. So it's kind of interesting maneuver. But But yeah, there is this sense that, you know, lawsuits are pending. They filed them that day. I mean, they basically were, you know, were ready.
Yeah.
They knew this was coming down. And it's not like we're going to go quietly. You know, we're not just going to roll over. We're going to fight this. And so I think there is, you know, there's definitely, you know, there've been movements, right? Native American empowerment movements. You know, and Regina told me, we're not, you know, we're different now. We're learning, you know, we're learning both worlds. We're learning how to fight, you know, in the Anglo world. Mm. We're learning, you know, the language. We're learning the law. And we're not going to just sit back.
Did you get a sense, Sean referred to this, a number of people do in the film, that there needs to be a way of finding a common language? There needs to be a way of finding a peacemaking process of, as you say, getting people from these different perspectives to see the perspective of the other people. Did you come away from, you know, dealing with this story with a sense of optimism that they can, or did it just seem so complicated? It's just you're unclear how they're going to manage it.
Yeah, it really seems overwhelming.
Yeah.
I mean, especially with the divisions and the polarization. You know, at one point, I think people were much more willing to sit down and talk. But there's also this sense of hope. And I think Angelo Baca embodies that notion that, you know, look, these are issues that we've had for a long time. They're not going to go away overnight. And it's time we started looking at how we view each other, how, you know, looking at racism, looking at land use, looking at what, you know, protection means, what sacred means. It's time that we actually can start looking at this and having dialogues.
Nancy Green, she's a producer for KUED Channel 7. Her documentary is called Battle Over Bear's Ears. It's showing tonight at 8 on KUED. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.